Hello and welcome to There's No Business Like, a podcast where friends and industry colleagues explore topics and interview leaders in our industry of professional theatrical touring.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to There's No Business Like. I'm Katie Miller with the Midland Center for the Arts in Midland, Michigan, and I am here with my co-hosts and co-producers, Brian.
Hey, Katie. Brian Zellmer from KU Presents in Kutztown, Pennsylvania.
Danielle.
Hey, it's Danielle Van Hook from the Alden in McLean, Virginia.
Kevin.
Kevin Maynard in Quad City Arts, splitting the border between Iowa and Illinois.
And Josh.
Last and least, Josh Benson in Marion, Illinois at the Marion Cultural and Civic Center.
Well, I am so excited to introduce...
Wait, we're going
to
let him keep least?
Yeah, yep. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Look, if he's going to be honest like that, we have to let him.
We don't like to censor each other here.
Yeah.
I am so happy to bring you my conversation today with an old friend of mine, David Alpert, a New York City-based theater director and podcast host. Before we get to my conversation with David, I want to ask you all, can you tell me what is a singing Christmas tree?
So I think a singing Christmas tree is like something that you buy at a department store that is similar to the Budweiser fish, where it's like you push a button and it like does, it says like two things, and somebody bought it in the 90s. And for some reason, it's still at your aunt's house and it probably sings an awful song.
That's a good guess, Danielle. I'm going to guess it is one of those, and I'm going to be judgmental here, one of those tacky trees that like turns around on a motor and plays music.
We used to have a talking Christmas tree for a festival of trees, which was like an animatronic thing. It didn't sing unless the person in there wanted to sing, but mostly it was there to scare children. I mean, to hang out with the children, but it did scare the children.
So. We had a talking egg for Christmas. His name was Egbert.
That makes perfect sense. Yeah, eggs at Christmas.
I immediately saw like this horrible atrocity of a costume that like surrounded like eight people with just their faces sticking out of it.
Kind of like the Times Square characters.
But their ears aren't out, so they can't actually hear each other to get the right harmonies. And that's what I picture.
That's nightmare fuel, Josh.
I know. My mind goes to dark places.
Well, you're all wrong. The singing Christmas tree is actually a tradition that comes from Mona Shores High School in Muskegon, Michigan, where hundreds of high school students stand on a tree structure and sing Christmas songs and perform for the general public. So David makes a reference to this because this is a program from his high school, and we will talk about that a little bit in our conversation. So I hope you enjoy my conversation with my friend David Alpert.
Hi, I'm David Alpert. I'm a New York City-based theater director, adjunct faculty member at New York University, and also the host and creator of E-Ticket to Broadway podcast.
David, welcome to There's No Business Like. I am so excited to have you on the show today.
I'm so happy to be here, Katie, my old friend who's still very young, but we are old friends.
We are old friends. So listeners know I'm from West Michigan. David and I are actually from the same town. We both grew up in Muskegon. Even though we're now both theater professionals, we actually never did theater together growing up in Muskegon. We actually know each other through the youth philanthropy world.
Yes. We both cared about helping Muskegon and the surrounding areas grow, but we were part of the Youth Advisory Council. Shout out to the Community Foundation for Muskegon County.
Yeah.
But we each represented our high school in making decisions with a lot of money and how it could benefit the youth of Muskegon.
Yeah, it was an amazing experience and I think set us up for our leadership roles that we like currently have in the arts industry today. So great opportunity, and it helped us cross paths. And I have been watching your career ever since we were in high school, and I'm so excited to have a chance to chat with you today.
I'm really excited to be here, and thanks for that. That's very kind of you.
Oh, you're so welcome. All right, we're just going to dive right in. I would love for you to just give us a little bit of an oversight of your career, a little bit of an introduction to you, and how did you get to like this moment where you are today?
I have always wanted to be a theater director, even in elementary school. The story I will always share is that in fifth grade at Churchill Elementary School, we did a Get to Know You project, and one of the squares, it was like favorite color, favorite sport, which I, of course, was like, I don't like sports, favorite food, favorite animal. And one was, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I said, a theater director. And I remember my teachers even questioning whether I meant Hollywood or what. And I said, No, I want to be a Broadway director. So Muskegon was full of great arts with Muskegon Civic Theater and Cherry County Playhouse. And where I went to school, Mona Shores, I had a lot of great arts programming. And so I always wanted to be a director. I did a lot of it growing up and then went to Western Michigan University. I got in as a lighting designer, but in my first interview said I'm a director, and they were really wonderful in helping me find a theater studies degree with an emphasis in directing. And I also did stage management there and then moved to New York in 2007, hit the ground running, and have been very fortunate to, you know, expand my career, not just as a director, but also as an associate director on Broadway shows. I was the founding artistic director of Broadway Con, which is the premier fan convention for Broadway. I created a benefit concert for Gilana's Fund for my sister when she passed away. And we've raised over $100,000 in helping kind of what we talked about with Youth Advisory Council, which Gilana was a part of, in making the world a more accepting, inclusive, and just place. And I've always loved teaching, and I found myself just about to complete my sixth year as an adjunct faculty member at NYU. So that's kind of the brief synopsis. I've been so lucky to just meet with and work with incredible people and still have those kind of pinch me moments of, oh, I guess I'm getting to work on Broadway shows, or I'm texting with this person that I used to listen to in the car at Western. You know, it's really cool.
Is that just kind of a surreal moment to think back to that moment at, like, at Churchill Elementary, where you're like, I want to be a theater director in second grade, and you are actually like living that dream out?
Yeah, it's weird because the dream is challenging. I mean, it's really hard. Every expression you've heard about New York City is true. Whether it's, you know, if you can make it there, you'll make it anywhere, or it's all about who you know, or, you know, everyone has a love-hate relationship. You know, I've been doing this for almost 20 years, and you really start to balance your dreams that you made as a kid with who you are as an adult, and kind of marrying those two and also divorcing those two at times. So it's been really fascinating, but still, you know, I'm at the time of us recording this, I'm prepping to direct an Earth Day concert in Times Square. And it's a lot of work, but it's like, oh, I guess I'm directing a concert in the middle of Times Square. Like, that's cool.
That's very cool. That is something that you don't necessarily think about as an opportunity as a director, right? That is like one of those things that we talk a lot about, like career pathways and pipeline within the industry. Like, that's not something that anybody ever talks to a high schooler about, like those sorts of opportunities. So I'm really fascinated to kind of like get into that a little bit more with you. But let's go back to Mona Shores High School for just a second. I want to make a note that Mona Shores, unfortunately, was the best theater program in the region when we were in high school. I went to a competing high school. But there's like a handful of Broadway professionals that have come out of Mona Shores. So Carly Gibson, who I know you guys went to school together, she starred in Hairspray on Broadway and in the national tour. Jill Chasson was in the original Company of Rent and Scarlet Pimpernel and did a bunch of other things. Obviously, you have been incredibly successful. So, like, what was the secret sauce? What was the magic that happened at Mona Shores High School?
I mean, definitely the choir program, you know, that was led by Sean Lawton, and before him, you know, Skip Frizzell, who started it, had a lot of opportunities, I think, from the Singing Christmas Tree, which, if you're listening to this, please Google it. There's not a great way to describe that. I don't know. I would give more credit, honestly, to Judy Johnson at Muskegon Civic Theater for all she did in the education department. I think Shores had a really great vibe, but it was just a really great school district that I think there was a lot of opportunities. Mm-hmm. And it felt very as diverse as West Michigan could be at that time. But as one of the few Jewish families in Muskegon, you know, that was not only, you know, accepted, but respected. And I got to do things that way. But yeah, Shores was a special place.
Yeah. We also had Cherry County Playhouse too, which was, right. For those not familiar, is like a really wonderful, it's defunct now, but a professional summer stock theater. They would use the Frauenthal and bring in national Broadway and film and TV talent to play these huge roles, and then would fill in small chorus roles with local teens and local performers, and that meshing of that professional opportunity.
Yeah. I did 3 summers back stage and learning how to professionally stage manage and company manage and do props. And I think it's also a shout out to Muskegon itself that with the Frauenthal, with national tours they would bring in, there was a great respect for the arts.
I think you're right. I think it's a combination of all of those things. And I think we were very lucky to grow up in an environment like that.
Definitely. The arts are important.
That's what we're trying to say. The arts are important. And I think exposure at a young age, and that, like you're saying, that opportunity to really truly participate is what sets people on that path. Okay, so Mona Shores, Magic Sauce, you went to Western. You mentioned it was incredibly, you know, supportive, and they helped set you on that path for directing. So then you hop to New York in 2007, and just knowing what I know, like, you got into directing pretty fast. So what was the path from the move to New York into associate directing and working on large scale projects?
I think knowing from a young age what I wanted to do really helped. And, you know, having very supportive parents who encouraged me, who never once said, like, you know, be a doctor. They were like, do it. Like, you know, my parents would sing show tunes at us all the time. I graduated from Western a semester early, and I used that semester to intern at the Guthrie Theater in Minneapolis. I went back to Western. They were very kind to let me put up a show in one of their black box spaces free of charge. I did some teaching. I actually did a tour. So I was getting kind of ready without making the move. When I moved to New York, the first thing I did, and this is before smartphones, what I did was I took time to reach out to everyone in the city that I knew, a lot of them from Cherry County, a lot of them from Western, to just start making connections. And very quickly, I connected. My first professional job in the city was with the former artistic director of Cherry County on a reading. You know, then I took a job that one of my friends from college, Lindsay, was in, and they needed a stage manager. And I was able to say, I can stage manage, but let me also be your assistant director. And then that director's friend was the assistant director of the 2009 revival of Guys and Dolls. They needed a second assistant director, and the connection was made. And so just over a year after moving to New York, I had booked my first Broadway show on the directing team. Again, it was kind of about who you know and really showing up and being kind and saying yes. I mean, we teach that in improv and in business, but like, mm-hmm. say yes, you know, as long as you're safe and respected, but say yes. So it kind of went quickly after that, that you book that first Broadway show, and that opens a lot of doors and connections. And you never know, you know, in this profession, you know that within 3 months, if you're on the creative side of things, you're moving offices, you're getting a new workplace. It's not like you get a job and you're there for 40 years. So you're always remembering how to make a good first impression, how to show up, and you have to work a little harder to, from the get-go, show what kind of worker you are. And I'm sure we're going to get into it more, but I spent most of my 20s directing at a festival level or concerts or occasionally, you know, a smaller project here and there. But the majority of my work was as an associate director on Broadway, off-Broadway and national tours.
That's an incredible trajectory. I just have to say, like, that is so fast. Knowing you as long as I have, like, it's not that surprising, but I guess I just didn't realize how quick that really was.
It was fast. And also, you know, of course, a huge part of my life is running the Living for Today concert mm-hmm. series for Gilana's Fund. And Gilana passed away a month and a half after I moved to New York. And it really, of course, just turned my world upside down. But I think as Gilana, you know, went to Indiana University to study acting, and was a, she and I were very similar in our points of view and theatrical flair. A lot of that felt like Gilana's push and kind mm-hmm. of just like, okay, I'm doing it for both of us now.
Right.
And so that was cool. And, you know, she shows up all the time, but it's really, I feel very lucky that I've been able to meet all these great people. And, you know, someone once said, there's no such thing as luck. It's preparation meets opportunity. And I've been preparing to be a director since I was a child. So to me, it's like, why hasn't this happened already? I've been using Happy Meal toys on, you know, to make Sets Night a puppet theater. Like, I'm ready. So it's been very exciting.
I do think you're the perfect example of that, and a great example of preparation meets opportunity for particularly young people that are looking to make the move, or maybe a little intimidated by that leap to New York or LA or wherever they're going to go. But I love that what you mentioned about just calling all the people you already knew, not being afraid to ask for that yeah. coffee meeting or an informational interview, or like, hey, do you know anybody? Like, that can be pretty intimidating. So how did you get over that?
I think I knew pretty quickly that everyone has to make the move at some point. I think about either directors I respected, or I think you can think of big Broadway stars. Like, at some point, Sutton Foster had to move to New York, and she had to get started. And you realize that it is just, everyone had to get started at some point. And we know this from community theater and high school theater. Theater always feels like the island of misfit toys. No matter what your talents are, your personality, there is a place for you in the theater. So I would never want it to be downstage center singing a solo. That wasn't me. I knew where my place was, but I knew that I had a place. And I hope anyone listening to this that's ever wanting to get involved with something, choose theater, because whether you're good in, you know, in the scene shop or in the costume shop or in the catwalks hanging lights, or you're comfortable on stage or calling a show or front of house, there's a place for you. So I think meeting theater people, I went into it knowing, like, if I was on the other side of it, I'd be happy to meet someone who wanted to work with me. And now that I do get the opportunity to be on that side, I always love meeting people and, you know, seeing if there's a way to guide them down the right path or a path that might be right for them in the moment.
I love that. And I love that full circle and that willingness to mentor and shepherd others and help others as they're starting out their journey. So thank you for being so willing to do that. Like, truly, it makes a huge difference. So let's talk a little bit about associate director. That might be a term that some people aren't really familiar with, especially if they're not in the Broadway world. So you mentioned second assistant director, you mentioned associate director. So what are those roles within the creative team? What's your role? What are your responsibilities?
You can think of it kind of like the director is almost like the CEO. And if there's like an executive assistant, oftentimes that's the assistant or associate. Assistant and associate can be the exact same job. Typically, associate comes when you've worked with that director before. It's perhaps a fancier title, but it's still the same. It's still the same thing. With both Michael Greif and Michael Wilson, who I had worked with multiple times, my first project with them was as the assistant director. And then on the second or third or fourth, it became associate. But basically what you're there to do is be a sounding board for the director, to take notes, to keep things in order, also to communicate so that when the director is at, like in tech, for instance, and the director is at that tech table in the middle of the dark house telling everyone what to do, the writers may come over with a new page or a new song and the director will sign off on it. And then it might be my job to run it to stage management, to run it to the actors, make sure that the lighting team has it, to really be an organized secretary in a way, but having a strong creative background. It depends on the production. It depends on the director. Some directors, like even when I have an associate, sometimes I'm really looking at them just to be my emotional support for a moment. And sometimes I'm looking at them to say, like, does this make sense? Or what do you think? And really allowing another set of eyes. Theater's collaborative. But being an associate or assistant is incredibly fulfilling and incredibly thankless because you have to know everything that's going on. But when it comes to like the opening night party, you're suddenly just sitting in the second balcony applauding the show. And that's okay. But it really is kind of this mystery position. Only recently has our union been able to get a union contract for associate directors and associate choreographers.
Really?
There was a long time that the only people working on a show that was not represented by a union were these two specific roles. I don't think people quite understood. They thought, you know, isn't that person just getting the director coffee? It's like, no, we are a huge communication asset to the show. And also when the director leaves to do another project, you need someone that remembers what the director was saying to work with actors. You know, on If Then, my last Broadway show, I was training different people to play the same role. And stage management has the blocking and they're there, but they're also looking at it from a different perspective. I can say, I know why this choice was made. And I also have experience in coaching actors. There's been rehearsal days where, you know, I'm sitting, taking notes, keeping everyone on track. The director has to leave. And then suddenly I'm in the director's chair. Or during Trip to Bountiful, which was a play by Horton Foote that starred Cicely Tyson and Vanessa Williams. We're in tech and we're doing a transition. And suddenly I'm on stage with a god mic blocking this transition. And I remember Michael, the director in the house, saying, David, do you need more time? And I said, yep, I need more time. And I just had that moment of like, I'm directing on Broadway. And it was just to help the director who's figuring out so many other things. Let me just figure out how to safely get Vanessa Williams off stage while the benches are going that way and the set is going. But you're like, oh, right, I'm doing it. So again, the assistant associate track, it can change per production, per day. You never know what you're getting yourself into, but it's ultimately really rewarding and a wonderful way to learn more about theater. I didn't go to grad school. I don't need to go to grad school because I've been in these rooms with Pulitzer Prize winning writers and Tony winning directors and watching how they work. I'm not sure how to get a better education than that.
What would you say would be like two or three of the top things that you took away from those experiences in particular?
Definitely how to give notes to actors, the respect in which those are given, how to phrase things, and how to read the room sometimes, knowing when to give a note. that was definitely a huge help. Looking at how to tech a multi-million dollar show, watching how scheduling is done. As a director, when I moved to New York, there's, I think, two paths. There's probably multiple paths, but one is to direct your own shows. Oftentimes, that's not going to come with a huge budget, and it's going to come with a lot of scrappiness, which I love and I miss. And then there's another path, which is assisting. For me, I chose that path because I think my ultimate goal is to be directing on Broadway. I think this is the better path to do it because I can get in the room and meet those people and meet these incredible actors who then, when I'm directing my own projects or concerts, I have a relationship with them. And even, you know, designers, I'm now working with people at the top of their game who have all this experience. So I'm learning a lot about that. And I think the other thing I'm learning about is how to create theater in a very high stakes environment. Mm-hmm. And watching how professional one must need to be and polite and kind and respectful. I have never been in such a professional setting than I have during a Broadway tech, where everyone is exhausted and working so hard, but yet they're polite and focused. I think we deep down know, like, we have so much on our shoulders, so much writing on this. This is so much work, but we are in this together.
Yeah.
So every time you see a show, again, I'm going to get on my soapbox, but like, there's no such thing as good or bad theater. It's whether you like it or not. Mm-hmm. Everyone might think, oh, this show is terrible. And it's like, you may dislike it, but you have to understand that is a lot of hard work that went into something. Broadway is like a shopping mall. There's some stores, like, listen, I'm always going to go to the Disney store, but there's some clothing stores I never am going to go into. But you know who is going to? My mom. And my mom loves that clothing store. And sometimes I want new stores to come in. And sometimes I'm really excited that the Disney store is still there. So we just have to remember that in art, not everything is meant for us. And I never want to be in a world where everything is meant for everyone. That would be boring.
I love that.
There should be shows that you leave saying, you know what? Good job. They did such a great job. It didn't speak to me. I didn't like it. But I hope that many people find love of this project.
I love that. I think we talk a lot in kind of the touring world about quality and quality as a gatekeeper. And what do we mean by quality and commercial work versus kind of quote unquote artistic work. But I like how you just framed that in terms of like, not everything's for everyone. No. And doesn't mean it's not good.
No.
Doesn't mean it isn't a quality production. It just might not be your taste.
Right.
So how do you feel about that sort of like idea of like gatekeeping and things are quality and not quality and they deserve to be seen, not deserve to be seen? Like, where do you kind of fall in that conversation from a Broadway perspective?
I would always say, like, who gets to make the decision of what is artistic or what is not? You know, I always go back to the first Broadway show that I saw, which was Cats. And people have a strong...
Me too.
Really? Yeah.
Wait a second. Time out.
I mean, the thing is, that show literally ran now and forever. It ran for so long. And it was a great gateway. And here's the deal. People feel strongly about Cats.
Oh, they do.
I was very confused when I saw it. I remember liking the music and being like, this is bold. But I it didn't speak to me.
Right.
But you know who it did speak to? The millions of people that bought tickets to see it. Mm-hmm. And so you can have anything like Next to Normal or Kimberly Akimbo, these smaller musicals that really spoke to me. But Broadway is a commercial institute. How do you pitch a show like that to a, you know, a family from West Michigan? And there's a lot of running costs. So it's like, it's going to be dependent upon that. But I don't think anyone gets to decide what's good or bad. I always will spin it to, if I took a group of people to the Pompidou in Paris or the MoMA in New York, a modern art museum, and we looked at a canvas, I don't think anyone in the group would point at that canvas and say, that is bad art. They would probably say something like, I don't get it, or I don't like it, or, you know, modern art's not really my thing. But somehow with musicals, with plays, with TV, film, we get to suddenly say that's good or bad. And I just strongly disagree with that. I think you can say, I dislike that. I don't like when people say, oh, you know, don't tell anyone, but I really love Wicked. It's like, I'm so glad you love Wicked. What a fun show. It's a spectacle. Wizard of Oz was probably hugely part of our upbringing. But I don't understand who gets to make the decision on what's good or bad. Ticket sales can be completely separate from quality, but I want to make sure that the artists creating it are doing it for a purpose, that it's about the audience and not about ourselves.
And I think when we talk about quality, that's more in like the execution, not in the sure. value of the art.
Totally.
That is maybe what sometimes we are trying to get at. Is it executed well? Does it have strong storytelling? Is it consistent all the way through?
Right.
Are the performances getting stronger as it goes on? Is the character development there? There's a difference in quality of execution versus quality of idea or quality of the sure. story.
We live in a time where theater prices are more expensive and union contracts are getting to be more expensive. And people expect spectacle sometimes. Mm-hmm. And it's like, how do we do that? But when you've got a new musical on Broadway, you get 8 shows a week
yeah.
with a set number of seats.
Mm-hmm.
How do you make the money back? Or on touring houses, you have a set number of seats. Mm-hmm. How do you make the money to pay everyone working on it? Plus the, you know, the touring costs, plus everything yeah. else. So it's really interesting how we're going to navigate this. I don't think we're going to solve it ourselves because we really have to ask the rest of the country. And we really need to look to the rest of the country to figure out, rather than, you know, saying we can't just suddenly cast someone new in Wicked. We have to think, okay, how do we change the audience to make sure they're not just expecting what they've already seen, which is another huge part of what I like. I always want to see, you know, that, like, for instance, I'm going to get very specific.
Go for it.
I love Wicked. Fiero has traditionally always been cast by an actor who has a similar body type. Well, why does it have to be that way? As long as the other students at Shiz University, when Fiero comes on stage, if they have the same reaction, I think we can still, as an audience, believe what the ensemble is saying. I think that's what the ensemble of a musical often does, lets the audience know what we should think. Just like when Elphaba comes on and she's green, for the audience, we don't shriek, but we watch them shriek. So it's like, okay, great. So let's change the body type of Fiero. But are the audiences going to go on that journey, or are they still going to be a little old-fashioned and think like, well, he doesn't look like this person? So how do we change that thinking? Mm-hmm. I think it's about going back into schools and community theaters and start changing the narrative there and really asking, well, why can't someone who looks this way be the love interest? So it's really, you know, I think it's our responsibility as theater people to go back and have conversations with audiences and challenge their mm-hmm. beliefs to make theater more representative of the world. That's my soapbox.
I love that. And I love getting into this part of the industry. As a director, mm-hmm. as a creative, then in talking to students, right, as they're coming up, talking to audiences, are you a fan of the talk back or the pre-show activities or, like, you know, some sort of engagement from the artists themselves to the audience to have those conversations and really bring those issues forward and explain artistic choices? Or do you want audiences to just see what they see and then sit with it and have to kind of like ponder it and process it themselves?
Definitely. I think it's a great question. I personally don't love talkbacks, only because I want the art to speak for itself. I'm all about a talkback that talks about context and history. If we're doing a show that was written at a different time, like specifically, you know, the golden age of Broadway of the 1940s and 50s, where people weren't represented accurately, I would love a talkback of, like, at the time of this writing, this is what was going on. But I always find it funny that celebrities, specifically performers who are great artists, are also tasked with this job of speaking eloquently about a subject. They don't have to, you know? Same thing, if I'm directing a show and someone asks me to write a director's note, I will often say I'd rather not, because what I want to say is hopefully clear in the piece. I just feel like we need everyone to make a statement about everything. And sometimes the statement can just be in the observation or the reflection. And I hope that as theater people, what we have to say is in the show. And then as soon as that curtain comes down, we move on with our lives. We do something else.
So one more question about directing. I want to particularly talk about your work with If Then and Flashdance. So you were associate directors for both of those shows on Broadway, and then you were the associate director for the national tour. So, and I am fascinated by this process of taking a show that sits down in New York and then putting it on the road. So what was your role, and what is that process like of transitioning from a Broadway theater where you're running hundreds of performances in a row and you're just kind of like sitting down and hanging out and having a good time, to then being on the road and doing single nighters or week long runs? Or what is that process, and what was your role in that with those two shows?
What's cool about taking shows on tour is there are so many incredible designers and technicians and management that really understand the process and how to do that. The craziest thing about taking a show on tour that you've done in a previous sit down is that you're on stage, you're doing your work, everything around you looks similar, and you step into the wings and you're like, I have no idea where I am. And if you get to go backstage of national tour, you will see thousands of arrows pointing you in places, but you do so much work on a Broadway show, you know, fitting where costume changes are going to be. And when you go on the road, you're like, oh, we have more space. So the transition to taking it on the road as a director doesn't really feel super different. The transition really is all about stage management and designers having to rethink. It's fun and it's crazy. So you never quite get that sense of, oh, I can relax. You're always on the move. You're changing hotel rooms. So yeah. it's a crazy job. It's Little Night Music singing Glamorous Life. You pack up and you move and you do it and then you pack up again, but it's...
And you do it again.
I love it. I think it's so fun.
That's amazing. So then how did these experiences, so being on, you know, associate directing on Broadway, prepping national tours, doing those sorts of things, how did that then prepare you for some of these other things that you've done with your career? So you've done a ton of events and concerts, and you were the founding artistic director for Broadway Con. You mentioned the Living for Today concert that you do for your sister at Joe's Pub. Like, so how did all of that prepare you for those sorts of opportunities? And how did you even get into kind of this, kind of these one-off opportunities that seem to be somewhat consistent for you? I'm suspecting because you're very good at them. But how did those things come to be? And then how is that same different? How were you prepared for those sorts of opportunities?
I think you learn quickly on a Broadway show how specific and exact you have to be with things and being very clear. Putting together an event like Broadway Con, I was programming the main stage. So, you know, you've got 3 days of hour slots. You're learning quickly how to be organized and clear with your vision and how to be a people person in a way, which is you're dealing with hundreds of personalities and how to get them to do what you need them to do in a very short amount of time and making sure that you don't have mistakes. So when you're doing a traditional show, you get rehearsals and tech rehearsals and previews. Everything else, Broadway Con, the Earth Day concert, Living for Today, I do an annual Amazon gig. It's all emails. It's really emails. And it's taught me about how to be incredibly respectful and kind to people's time, but also very direct in what I need. You don't have time to beat around the bush to say like, and maybe you can sing. I have to say like, I need you to sing two songs. They need to be like this. Here's an idea for you. And again, understanding that on the other side of it, I've had actors say to me, thank you for being so organized and direct because you have to, you don't have the time to kind of figure it out. So I think like having my 20s to really work with these people that know exactly what they want has really helped. And, you know, my favorite quote is an artist is someone who's learned to trust themselves. Mm-hmm. So it's trusting that even when I'm on a phone call with a whole new team of people, I have to think like, okay, I know what I want. I have to just say it. And I have to say, you know, this morning with like the Times Square Alliance, they do everything in Times Square. I have to say like, well, this is what I need and this is what I want. And can we do this? It's really nice. I think people respect you when you can be very direct with your wants and also being, you know, clear with what's doable, you know, managing your expectations to know, mm-hmm. okay, we only get this day to do it. If something messes up, okay, we're going to prepare the best we can. Never did I think I'd be having all these opportunities, but you learn that like, theater kids can do anything. We know what it's like to meet a deadline. We know what it's like to work on it with a team. And it's truly collaborative. You know, in what other field is everyone truly working on the same thing, which is when the lights go out and the audience is there and the show starts, we've all worked for that moment.
Mic drop.
Oh, no. You can't drop your mics. The sound team would be so mad.
No, honestly, a truer statement has never been said, David, about, I think, what we do as theater. And I love those things that you just brought forward. I think we, especially as Midwesterners, we do tend to be a little softer and a little bit more like, yes. Oh, well, if you're willing to, could you? So I like that advice and that thoughtfulness around being just direct and really saying like, yes, this is the expectation. This is what's doable. This is what we need to make this happen. And then going from there. So I think that's really great practical advice.
And also find the solution. Immediately find the solution. I don't like when people say no. Say, that doesn't work, but what if we do it like this? Or really quickly, if there's a curveball, it's like, okay, great. We're going to solve the problem. On a Broadway show, if you get new pages and they go into the show that night, you figure it out. And I think we're living in a world where that can be scary and it feels like I need more time. But it's like, you can take more time, but what if we just figure it out together?
I love that. So then with all of these various opportunities you have and projects that you're working on. And you mentioned earlier, you know, even if you're working on a Broadway show, you know it's not going to last forever. How do you manage like your business side? Essentially, you are a small business, right? You are running a business for yourself. You're doing freelance work. You're picking up this gig, that gig. How do you manage the business side? Do you have an agent? How are you negotiating contracts? How are you figuring out what you are worth and what you should be paid for these sorts of gigs?
Is there a question? It kind of goes back to being incredibly organized. My friends will tease me. If you look at my text messages, I delete them because I use my text as a to-do list. So I'm always checking it. So sometimes my to-do list is 20 things long. And sometimes it's like, okay, I've got to do that. Same with email inboxes. I use it as a to-do list. You know, in my 20s where I wasn't the person in charge, I had to be even more creative because I couldn't just say to the director, I'm going to be a half hour late today because I have to go teach. Now that I'm in that position of power, I can schedule things. 2 years ago, I was directing my off-Broadway debut while at the same time producing and directing the NYU showcase. So I had to be very creative, but I could make that happen. Luckily, there's unions, and I'm pro-union in the sense of them helping us negotiate. I've had two agents in my 17 years in New York. I'm not currently with an agent, but SDC, my union, is really good about being, well, this theater company has to pay you at least this amount and this, this, and this. But I think with experience, you start to kind of figure it out and then knowing your worth. You know, listen, in my 20s, my first Broadway show, I got paid $1,100 for 3 months of work. That was nothing. But at the time, I was very grateful that I had saved up money and that I was able to do it. You know, that's not true for everyone. And now, of course, now it's that those kind of jobs hopefully don't exist. Hopefully, you know, even the what I used to do now comes with a weekly stipend. And but we're talking almost 20 years ago, you know. It's changed a lot. So you're looking at your union for advice. You're checking with your tax people. When I do taxes, it's a lot. There's a lot of paperwork. There's a lot of forms. But it's really about, as you said, it's being the CEO of your own company and, you know, always looking ahead and breathing and just staying really organized and really being on top of it.
That's incredible. Well, thank you for sharing that and being so transparent, honestly, about managing that and figuring out what your worth is, because I think business is a hard thing for us to talk about. And I think there's something to dig into at another time about why it's acceptable to pay artists so little for their time and talent. That's like, yeah. I know a larger industry question and we're working through that, but it's still, I think back to similarly when you were starting out, when I was starting out my first management job, like, the pay was ridiculously low. And the fact that, you know, we tolerated that or we were okay with that, I think says a lot about inexperience, but also about people feeling free to take advantage of others.
And like the world is waking up to that. And it's really like, I will always take a look at where the money's coming from for something. If I'm doing a benefit concert and I look at not just where the money's coming from, but also how different people are being paid. So if there's not a lot of money coming in for something, I want to make sure that it's all to scale, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. But I also understand that like, if I'm doing a concert, that's not exclusive. I'm doing a concert in addition to five other things that month.
Right.
Because I understand that it doesn't always pay that much.
So let's talk a little bit about your work as an adjunct professor at NYU. So you were a student, we talked a little bit about your educational background. So what is it like being on the other side of that now, being a professor and working with students who are 25 years your junior or something like that? It's a very different time and students today are just different than we were back in the day, right? So what has that experience been like for you? And maybe what's your favorite part about working with students today?
I love teaching. It's so much fun. The world has changed a lot. As you said, people can now get information from so many different places. So I may be speaking to them with, you know, 20 years of experience directing Tony winners at Carnegie Hall and on Broadway. And yet they might be like, well, this person on Instagram told me this. And I'd be like, okay, interesting. I always say to my students, if they're taking outside classes, pay attention to the person and what they have done who's teaching you as well. Everyone has an opinion and everyone now has a platform. So it's really trying to make sure you're navigating that. So you're taking information from people that have done it. I'm always shocked when I see people online telling you what songs you must not sing in an audition room. It's like, first of all, have you ever cast a show? Have you ever been in an audition room?
Right.
So I teach audition skills at NYU in the fall, and it's really wonderful to see these students expand into different styles. And the big thing that we push is to be your authentic self, right? When I was in college, there was definitely an image and persona of what a Broadway performer looked like. Mm. And I saw my peers get told things that wasn't quite accurate and might have been damaging. So my job, you know, 20 years later, is to make sure you're bringing the best in everyone and encourage them to say things like, I may do it this way, someone may do it differently, but it's so much fun to just help these students find their voice. I know that sounds so cliche, but it's truly like, it's really fun to challenge them and to push them. I do come at it from a place of, you know, experience of casting and coaching. And I think coaching specifically, actors are such brave, vulnerable people, and you want to make sure that as you coach them, you are being very careful not to, you know, say the wrong thing or damage them in any way.
I feel like that is in line, again, sort of like talking about how the industry is kind of shifting and changing. I feel like that is more in line with where we're headed to today. We're much more thoughtful about the emotional lives of everyone that we are dealing with. We just have more of an awareness, which I really love and appreciate. Certainly wasn't that way when we were starting out.
And also, we must remember that the actors on stage are not the only artists in the building,
yes.
Right? And we sometimes give that kind of a hall pass. It's like, no, we all need to be checking in with each other. We all need sufficient breaks. We mm-hmm. all need to be taken care of. You know, I spend my days checking with all my actors, but sometimes I want someone to say like, hey, David, how are you doing? How do you feel about the scene? Because I'm just as vulnerable. Mm-hmm. You know,
I love that perspective. And well, you said earlier, like the director is kind of like the CEO, like there's a lot to shoulder and there's got to be a lot of weight there too. So yeah, checking in with our directors. What a novel concept.
Directors and stage managers also need a 5-minute, 10-minute break.
Yes.
Know? When we put the actors on a break.
Yeah. Can we give some snaps for our SMs, by the way, like our stage managers?
I picked up another degree in stage management, so I love working with stage managers, but it's like when the actors are put on a 10-minute break, I will not always use that time to turn to my stage manager to work. It's like, you should also break. We're putting on a show, by all means. We're not getting paid enough. We're not getting enough sleep because of the nature of the job that we have chosen. What we do as theater people, even with health insurance, even with proper pay, it's still going to be a challenging thing because we work while others play. By nature of our job, it's weird. It's really hard.
So one more question about your very multifaceted career, David. You mentioned in your intro that you are a podcast host, and of course we're on a podcast. So I'd love for you to give us just the quick rundown of your pod. Explain to us the title, because if you're not really a Disney person, it might not make sense.
Yes.
Why did you make that decision? And has it just been like a ton of fun to do that since you launched it?
Yeah. So in 2020, which was a memorable year, I had two off-Broadway shows that were canceled, and I found myself with nothing to do. And NYU, you know, finished for the year. And my agents at the time really encouraged me to do something. And a college professor from Western, Cheryl, we were talking about some stuff. And I don't listen to podcasts. I think they're wonderful and great, but I don't have that kind of attention span. So thank you all for listening and making it this far. I literally was like, okay, I could do a podcast, but like, what would I talk about? I was going to maybe do something with philanthropy, ironically, and Broadway, but I was like, no. So this is a time when Broadway had shut down and the Disney parks had shut down. And if there's anything I like more than directing, it's Disneyland. And probably I do like Disneyland more than directing. Disney parks and theater are the same thing. They're immersive entertainment. And I found during my years at BroadwayCon how many people that worked on Broadway loved going to the parks. Listen, I don't understand why people say things like Disney adult, because we don't say like sports adult or fashion adult. We are allowed to like things. When Walt Disney started the parks, he mentioned that it was for the young and the young at heart and was built as something for people of all ages. So I started this podcast called E-Ticket to Broadway. E-tickets were when the parks first opened, there were ticket books for the rides. So an A-ticket would be maybe on a slower, less exciting ride. And an E-ticket would be like the thrill ride, like a Space Mountain. Even though the ticket books have gone away, you will still hear things like a new e-ticket attraction. So the podcast is called E-Ticket to Broadway, to talk about exciting things. And so what started to be maybe 10 episodes have been closer to 60. It's been really wonderful. And the intention behind the podcast was to spread joy. In 2020, I said to all my guests, we're not going to mention pandemic. We're not going to mention COVID. We're going to talk about how much we love it. And people responded beautifully. And so I've been able to interview everyone from, you know, Tony-winning Broadway stars to Broadway stars who also voice Disney characters. So I got to interview Jodie Benson, who's not just a Tony nominee, but the voice of Ariel, or Adina, who's not just the voice of Elsa, but a Tony winner, mm-hmm. or Jonathan Freeman, who is Jafar. But it's always fun that theater people, I think at that time, they were asked to talk about their process and their background, which is important, but I think we were all pretty devastated that our career went away. Yeah. And a lot of people said yes to me because I was like, here's an hour to talk about your favorite snack at the parks. So anyway, give the podcast a listen. It's super fun and a lot of really wonderful people in there.
You have some really amazing guests. And two of our friends that we mentioned earlier from Muskegon, Shields and Carly, were guests. And I listened to those in particular and had so much fun. And I listened to the Jodie Benson one. And it is such a hoot. And I love bringing your two loves together and finding that joy and sparking that joy for others. I think it's like such a wonderful thing. And I love that you've continued it beyond the pandemic. But it's nice to have something that's purely just fun and joyful that you can listen to and get a little bit of a flavor of, you know, the people that you love to watch, like a little bit of their backstory and history and what makes them happy too.
Right.
I really appreciate it about listening.
And also, I'm so grateful you've listened. That's like Disney parks and Disney movies are often our gateway to musical theater.
Absolutely.
Like we listen to Little Mermaid and we're like, oh, that sounds like Little Shop of Horrors. Oh, right. It's the same mm-hmm. people. And Disney parks that way too. But it's really that. It's really a product of love and joy. And what I said in 2020 was, listen to this on your way to the voting booths. Listen to this on your way to a protest. We are giving so much of ourselves with anger and passion, but sometimes we have to refuel with some joy.
I love that. So you may not know this about our podcast, David, but we really don't have any assets except we have a time machine. One of our co-hosts, Brian, just one day showed up with a time machine. So what I'd like to do is we're going to buckle in. I want to take you back in time to, let's say, a few months after you moved to New York and you're starting to make those contacts and get your feet under you and figure out like what this path is going to be. What do you know now that you wish you had known then?
I would have definitely talked to me about fashion and clothes that fit, because as a kid from Muskegon, Michigan, I shopped at Old Navy a lot. So I learned that. I would talk about quality of living. But I think in terms of career, I would go back and say, don't be afraid to say what you want and what you need and to really go for it. It's something that I need some, you know, the David from 55 to come back and tell me now. But I think that's the thing that you've mentioned as artists. We've sometimes, you know, fallen into the trap of we're so grateful to have the job. But what we saw during the pandemic is that everyone relies on the arts. We all went to Netflix and we all listened to albums and we relied on it. Mm-hmm. And we could sense the emptiness. And we are the people to make that happen. So we should stand up for ourselves and say, your show will need a director. Let that be me. You want something to do on this weekend, I will create the concert. So I think I would just say, like, believe in yourself. And trust that not only does young David want to work with people, that hopefully other people want to work with David. And so it's really kind of changing that narrative that's been helpful for me.
I'm so grateful that we had this time together today. It's been so wonderful.
It's been fun.
I want to know, what is your favorite thing about working in the industry today?
I think it's the people. I think it's still like, whether they're, you know, I still giggle when I work with people that I used to, you know, watch on the Tonys or, you know, listen in my Aztec at Western, my ugly blue car. That's always really cool. But I really think it's the people and also the collaborative nature of it all. I think it's so fun that, you know, I'll look at a script and then I'll meet with a designer and they'll have an idea and I'll be like, wow, that's really cool. I never thought about that. And then it just brings you back to what we did as kids where we're playing pretend and I get paid to do that. Or I get paid to, you know, coach a student and be like, here's a stupid idea and then watch it happen. Or, you know, as I say to my mom a lot, it's my puppet show. It's my puppet theater come to life. You know, I get to do this for a living. It's really hard. The business is hard, but the art is fun. So I really just love, you know, being in a rehearsal room and being silly and trying new things and getting to play pretend.
Well, that's a perfect note for us to end on. Again, thank you so much for spending this time with me today. It's
of course, Kate. Oh,
it's been so fun catching up and getting to see you again. And I think it's pretty amazing what we can, a couple of kids from Muskegon, Michigan, and our friends in the industry have been able to accomplish and the things that we get to make happen for others. So it's really great to share this space with you.
Awesome. Thanks, Katie.
So Katie, love the interview, but I think I have to ask the question that we're all thinking is, did you choose to interview David because he also saw Cats as his first musical?
Well, clearly I didn't know that. I was so surprised when David said that.
I could hear the disappointment in your voice whenever he said it didn't speak to him.
It didn't speak to him. Because I thought it was going another way at first. And when he said it didn't speak to him, I was like, oh. But he did talk about it being a gateway, which it is, which we've talked about before, too.
Yeah, it's totally a gateway. And no, I didn't know that. It delighted me that we have that in common as well, which I did not know about.
So you did actually ask the question that I was wondering, which is like, what is an associate director? And like, how is that different from an assistant director? I thought was really cool. And I loved how he highlighted all the different like things he had to do and the unglamorous side of it, you know, because I do think there's a push in our industry and in all the different trades and aspects to go to grad school. What he was able to do in his 20s and all of the experience he was able to get, like in a job where, you know, a lot of it is preparation and a lot of it is luck, to be able to build that network and make some luck for yourself seems like a really smart move.
I don't know that I would even say luck as much as it's the saying yes and then advocating for yourself. I mean, he said yes to being a stage manager, but then advocated for himself and said, but let me also be an assistant director. He advocated for himself to put himself into that position to start doing it in the first place, to make that step from stage manager to assistant or associate director. And I think advocating for yourself while saying yes to things is an incredibly powerful asset.
And he also put in the time before he got there by reaching out to everyone he knew in the city. I mean, just as an opportunity to get more involved. And I think that all of those three things combined is what led to sort of an expedited career path and getting to where he wanted to be, probably a bit quicker than maybe even he thought he would. And I think most people thought he would. So I think that's a nice, easy takeaway. It's just like, you know, reaching out and making those phone calls.
The thing that popped out to me the most was about not saying no and basically turning that around and saying, find the solution. I wrote down find the solution because that was the quote that just really jumped out.
I also think that what I love about that is like, that's the characteristic that I always talk about theater people, is that like, that is the most important thing, is that, you know, good theater people aren't really quick to say no. Like, they're sort of thinking about like, what is that solution or how can we get to yes? And 9 times out of 10, that yes is just, it takes a lot of money, which sometimes it forces the no, but there's always like, hey, I think we can get there, versus instantly going, no, we're done. I love the conversation where he's talking about, you know, this piece of art or this theater being not for me, which is something that I've become really good at. I will push back just a little bit on what David said about going to an art museum and saying that this is bad art. Being in the visual arts world, I can tell you that we hear that a lot. Or people talk about that a lot, like this is bad or this is not good. I am a firm believer of the exact what David said. When it comes to all art forms, I try to just tell people like, this is not for me. That there's a lot of things that in both visual art and the performing arts where, you know, you can see that it takes some skill, it takes some time, it takes some activity to go into that. And that's the things that I choose to focus on there.
And I also think that there, as an artist, like through your growth as an artist, you need to make some bad art. The key to it is like, as an artist, you make bad art to learn from it. And at that point, you don't know that you're making bad art. Looking back on projects that I've done, like, I've made some really bad art to develop my skills and to get better and to get there. I still look back on the first set design that I ever did for theater and just laugh at it because of how horrendously bad it really was. And it got put on stage. But I learned from that, and I learned what the use of the space was from that. And I learned that like just filling the space with a bunch of random shapes doesn't do a thing for you if there's no purpose behind them. And so there's so much to be learned from creating bad art that I think it's important to state that there is bad art, just not on that Broadway level. It's gone through so many things to get there that it's at that level, it's just not your taste or it's really fucking good.
So after having this conversation with David and this whole conversation about taste from good and bad art and that sort of thing, I think something that we have been maybe circling around, but I haven't quite put my finger on the right language for, that came to me after this conversation, was the idea of sophistication. And I think when we talk about good art, bad art, quality, not quality, maybe part of that conversation is this idea of, are people sophisticated enough to understand or appreciate and we need to explore our own biases around people's background, where they come from, their socioeconomic status, and how that and history and how that plays into what we believe is quality or what we should be presenting in our venues, or if this Broadway show is good or bad. Like David made a comment about like people being embarrassed that they like Wicked. Why are people embarrassed that they like Wicked, right? Is that seen as a less sophisticated show than something else? But I think there's a layer that we haven't quite touched on, and I think my conversation with David brought it out, this our biases around sophistication. And some people can't appreciate quote unquote sophisticated art, or can't understand it or appreciate it because they come from a certain background. I think we've kind of been circling around that and when we've had these various conversations with guests, and it really jumped out to me after talking to David. So I want to sit and ponder that a little bit more, and I challenge everyone to think about that and explore your own biases.
It's also just so important that when we're in these creative spaces that we keep reminding each other and having the conversation of how we talk to each other matters, and especially like in a very visual and like body focused kind of industry, like you can't act without your body. The way in which you talk about how people's bodies are moving or how they look in certain costumes or different ways of giving notes can be really supportive, or it can create really harmful, stressful environments. And to go into all of those situations, like with an open heart and a heart that's there to create art, but like also remembering that the other people around you are also people and need to get that love sometimes too.
When he was talking about choosing the path that he did and just how he gets to be in the room with all the different people and meet everybody and work with them, and they get to know him and he gets to know them, essentially building relationships. And we keep coming back to that time and time again, how important that is, no matter what your role is, no matter what you're doing in this industry, it's all about the relationships.
Well, everyone, thank you so much for joining us today on There's No Business Like. I want to thank David once again for spending so much time with me in conversation. It was so good to have you with us, my longtime friend. And I hope we get to chat again soon. I hope you join us next time here on There's No Business Like.
All right, everyone. Thanks for listening to There's No Business Like. Our producers and hosts are Brian Zellmer, Josh Benson, Kevin Maynard, Katie Miller, and me, Danielle Vanhoof. Views expressed in this podcast are ours alone and are not reflective of the organizations we are a part of. Keep up with us at nobusinesslike.com. There you'll find links to all of our episodes and socials. If you like this podcast, give us a like, a follow, a review, or our favorite, a 5-star rating. Oh, wait, what was that site? I got it. Don't worry. It is nobusinesslike.com. Do I sound out bus-I-ness every time I type it? Yep, sure do. Stay in touch, my friends.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to There's No Business Like.
Hi, Katie.
Hey,
Katie.
Josh. Hello, everyone.
Hi.
Nope.
Well, that was kind of fun.
Denied by Kevin. All right. Well, hello, everyone, and welcome back to There's No Business Like. I'm Katie Miller with the Midland Center for the Arts in Midland, Michigan, and I am here with my co-hosts and co-producers, Brian. Brian? Is Brian there? Josh? What's going on with Brian? Danielle.
Danielle Van Hook from the Alden in McLean, Virginia.
I could barely hear Danielle for some reason. Did you say something?
I'm just confused why you didn't go.
I intro'd you and you just completely ignored me.
Oh. All right, do it again. Let me hear it.
Did you just have a stroke?
I thought it was a bit.
Yeah, I was like, it's either a bit or a medical emergency.
But you really held it, man.
Yeah.
That was good. Like, I was like, yep, here we go. Jumping on board. This is yes and. And by yes and, I mean no.